And good afternoon. You're listening to Boise State Public Radio News. We're getting ready for Idaho Matters and for a special announcement by Governor Brad Little regarding the COVID-19 pandemic. With me, Jemma Gaudette. Hey, Jemma, we're waiting for the governor.
Yeah, we are, Sam. Really, all we know at this point is that he will be holding a news briefing, basically, not even a news conference. Should last about 10 minutes or so in regards to the COVID-19 pandemic. That is basically all we know at this point. So be sure to listen to the governor's briefing. And then as soon as that's over, since it is Friday, we will, of course, have our reporter roundtable here on Idaho Matters. And two of our panelists, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News and Betsy Russell with the Idaho Press, are listening in as well as are our other two panelists. But, you know, as a lot of you may be aware, Kevin and Betsy cover the legislature every year. Yeah, and so we'll be breaking down and talking more in depth about this announcement. But really, Sam, we're all kind of in a little bit of suspense right now.
We are. We're just trying to. Oh, wait, I see the governor. Okay, let's join him.
As your governor, I have worked hard to protect the lives and critical health care capacity for the entire state while keeping families safe and businesses and schools open. Every decision has been a balancing act. And while the pandemic response has not been perfect, I do believe we achieved a balance. How can we tell? Because we have managed to prevent a crisis in our hospitals. We have kept our state open longer than almost every other state. Because now, thanks to quick action during the pandemic, Idaho has the strongest economy in the nation and the most financially solvent state budget. With our record budget surplus, we are poised to provide Idahoans historic tax relief and make strategic investments in building Idaho's future for us and our children. Few states can claim that kind of success. We are in the final lap of the pandemic fight. The finish line is close. We are so close to returning to normal. But all that success is threatened by the actions taking place in the legislature right now. Every single state has an active emergency declaration in place to respond to COVID-19. President Trump issued two emergency declarations that remain in effect today. When the Teton Dam broke in 1976, during the 1996 Panhandle floods, whenever there's a devastating wildfire, we initiate an emergency declaration at the request of local communities so Idaho can access critical federal resources, resources we all pay for to overcome the impacts of the crisis. Every time we used emergency declarations appropriately, COVID-19 is no different. An emergency is, quote, a serious, unexpected, and often dangerous situation requiring immediate action. Let me be clear. Undeniably, COVID-19 is an emergency. Hundreds of Idahoans have died, and many more have been horribly sick. Many Idahoans still face the same terrible risk. The COVID-19 emergency declaration was requested by Idaho communities, and it is critical in order for Idaho to receive federal assistance, your taxpayer dollars, to manage this crisis. The COVID-19 emergency declaration has enabled us to quickly cut red tape and increase healthcare access. These are the facts. Here is the myth. The emergency declaration somehow shuts down Idaho or takes away your rights. That is patently false. Amazingly, some in the Idaho legislature are perpetuating that myth and actively seeking to end Idaho's COVID-19 emergency declaration. What does that mean for you, the citizens of Idaho? It means less vaccine, more taxes, and more red tape. It means the vaccine rollout is jeopardized, something that is unacceptable in this final stretch of our pandemic fight. It means cities and counties will have to find funds from you to pay for equipment and support they need to battle COVID-19 in your community. It means hospitals could lose access to critical supplies. It means we lose the funding to utilize the Idaho National Guard to support testing, vaccine distribution, food banks, and medical facilities, something that has been a game changer in the pandemic fight. It means we cannot cut red tape and break down regulatory hurdles that stand in the way of better health care access. It means your federal tax dollars go to California, New York, and other states. It means this terrible pandemic and the disruption to your lives will be extended, not ended. Some members of the Idaho legislature are seeking political gain by perpetuating this misinformation about emergency declarations. They are playing politics, and unfortunately, the loser in this shameful game will be you, the citizens of Idaho. Members of the Idaho House admit they are not sure of the financial impact of ending the emergency declaration. Why then would you move forward with such a damaging move for our citizens, one that will cost Idaho taxpayers tens of millions of dollars? The Idaho Senate has made it clear they understand the importance of continuing to access federal assistance to overcome the crisis. Why then are you intent on moving forward with an action that will have the opposite effect? I want the people of Idaho to know that I have explained to legislators for months the importance of the emergency declaration and the reasoning behind all the decisions related to the pandemic response. I have sought their input and applied their advice to the state's response. I want the people of Idaho to know that I am firm in my assertion that the actions of the Idaho legislature severely jeopardizes our ability to roll out vaccine and bring the pandemic to an end in Idaho. As I have stated over and over, the no action alternative has never been an option. Pretending there is no COVID-19 emergency, as some in the Idaho legislature are doing right now, will have devastating impacts on our lives, our healthcare heroes who are protecting families, and our economy. Those who know me know that I greatly value my legislative partners. Cooperation between the executive and legislative branches is required and expected for those of us in elected office to best serve the people of Idaho. However, the seriousness of this situation demands that I speak up. I believe in my heart that what the Idaho legislature is doing is harmful to our people and wrong for Idaho. I urge my partners in the legislature to stop the political gains and do what is right for the people of Idaho. Abandon the myth that the emergency declaration somehow shuts down Idaho. Abandon the myth that the emergency declaration somehow infringes on your rights. Abandon these irresponsible attempts to undo Idaho's emergency declaration, an action that only puts the lives and livelihoods of our families and neighbors in jeopardy. I don't want to be doing this. I don't want us to focus all this energy on the past 11 months. I want us to focus on the future. We have a bright path ahead of us. Idaho's economy and state budgets are outperforming every other state. We have the strongest economy and the most financially solvent state budget. We have stayed open longer than almost every other state. We absolutely would not be in this phenomenal position right now if we did not have the emergency declarations. If we were not able to act quickly during the darkest months of our pandemic fight. Idaho, I will continue to work hard for you and make responsible decisions that help us get through this crisis together. I would like to introduce General Mike Garshak, the leader of our Idaho National Guard, to explain in more details what is at stake if the emergency declarations go away. General?
Thank you, Governor. Thank you for the opportunity to tell our fellow citizens how much their Idaho Guard has contributed to the health, safety, and security of our state and nation throughout the last year. It has truly been a historic time for the National Guard, both here in Idaho and throughout the entire United States. The Idaho National Guard has deployed to combat operations in Southwest Asia. We've fought wildfires in California and responded to civil unrest emergencies in our nation's capital. Right now, over 300 Idaho Guardsmen are returning this weekend after providing security during our nation's presidential inauguration. Here in Idaho, upon the governor's emergency declaration in March, members of the Guard immediately responded to requests for assistance from food banks throughout the state to help those most in need, as well as providing storage and distribution of critical PPE. Since then, our support has expanded to assisting every health district throughout the state, conducting missions such as patient screening, testing, administrative and logistical support, and most recently, distributing and administering the COVID-19 vaccine. I'd like to share a few examples of the Guard's impact throughout this emergency response. At some of the busiest testing locations around the state, Guard support has helped reduce the amount of time it takes to receive a COVID test by nearly 95%, enabling more people to receive a test safer and faster than ever before. Just in the last month, Guardsmen have facilitated nearly 70,000 COVID screenings and tests throughout the state. Guard support has allowed Idaho's most highly trained and skilled healthcare professionals to focus on direct patient care, while our soldiers and airmen carry out many of the COVID-related administrative and support functions, reducing strain on providers and staff, allowing them to deliver the best possible care to our citizens. As I travel throughout the state to observe your Guard in action, the common message from healthcare providers is that the Guard support has been absolutely essential in enabling them to provide the necessary care and treatment to their patients. It has literally saved lives. We're currently preparing to activate an additional 200 Guardsmen to facilitate the governor's efforts to rapidly distribute and administer the COVID-19 vaccine, making it available to all citizens throughout all areas of Idaho. Currently, every state in the nation is using their National Guard to respond to this emergency. And at a moment like this, just as the Guard begins distributing and administering the vaccine, it is not the time to stand down. Canceling Idaho's emergency declaration would do just that. In order for the National Guard to respond to domestic emergencies beyond 72 hours, a formal disaster declaration is required by law. Also, a critical factor to consider is cost. During the emergencies, such as COVID-19 pandemic, an emergency declaration is necessary to receive state and federal disaster response funding. In my opinion, it would be negligent to cancel the emergency declaration at this pivotal moment, denying the citizens of Idaho the necessary support to ensure their health, safety, and welfare. The brave men and women of the Idaho National Guard join to serve the citizens of our state and nation in times of need. They never back down from a challenge, and they truly live up to our motto of always ready, always there. And I'd like to take this opportunity to express my sincere appreciation for the enduring support from our families and employers of our Idaho Guardsmen, without which we could not accomplish our mission. Thank you.
Thank you, General, and please express to all the people on the front line, the Guardsmen and women that are, whether they're in Washington or whether they're out on the front lines or whether they're ready, our sincere thanks. To the people of Idaho, throughout the pandemic, I have endeavored to protect you, your loved ones, and our economic prosperity. I will never relent in that pursuit. I am asking for your help to finish the fight. Please join me. Contact your state legislators and tell them not to take away one of our strongest tools to end this pandemic and get back to normal. Tell them Idahoans' lives and livelihoods depend on it. Thank you.
And that was Governor Brad Little speaking about the COVID-19 pandemic in regards to emergency declarations. It is Friday. This is Idaho Matters, and our reporter roundtable is beginning now. Today we have Kevin Richard with Idaho Ed News, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spachik, reporter with the Idaho Press, and Betsy Russell, Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press. Guys, I want to get right into this because I have to say, I think that Governor Little, A, wasn't pulling punches, but this is the sternest I think I have ever heard him. Kevin or Betsy, who would like to start with what we just heard?
Well, yeah, I'll jump in. Zero words minced this afternoon. We knew that there was a power struggle looming at the legislature over separation of powers, the coronavirus response, the legislature's feeling that they've been left out of this process. The governor laid it on the line in his view that millions of dollars are on the line here. Basically, the talking point that you heard from him this afternoon is if this goes through, we're looking at fewer vaccines and higher taxes. I've not heard him come out this strongly against the Republican legislature in the time that he's been in office.
I mean, to the point, Betsy, of saying, quote, your legislators are playing a shameful game.
He did, and he accused some legislators of seeking political gain by misrepresenting the actions that they're taking and the effect that they had. The governor said very clearly that COVID-19 is an emergency with people dying and getting sick, and that the legislature in addressing concerns over restrictions is aiming at the wrong target by attempting to do away with the disaster emergency declaration, because it was the disaster emergency declaration that is actually enabling the aid to help the state deal with the pandemic and to get the vaccine to try to stop it, as opposed to that disaster emergency declaration imposing restrictions. Now, there are other laws that allow restrictions to be imposed, but it was a very, very strong message from the governor that the legislature, at least some of the proposals that have been put out thus far, are aiming at the wrong target, and we're going to shoot the people of Idaho in the foot.
Right. I'm quoting a couple of things that the governor said right now. He said that the House admits that they do not understand the fiscal impact of something like this. And then he said, quote, why would you move forward then with something that would cost tens of millions of dollars, unquote. In fact, he said your federal tax dollars would then go to California, New York, or other states. It means this disruption will be extended, not ended. So Kevin, I mean, then he goes on to say, contact your representative.
Yes. I mean, he's taking the fight to the legislature and hoping to get Idahoans to weigh in on this issue. You know, he's fundamentally correct in what he's saying about legislators not knowing the fiscal impact of this. I've listened to legislative committee hearings twice this week where proponents of rescinding the emergency declaration have basically said they don't know whether this is going to affect FEMA funding. I listened to a Senate State Affairs Committee hearing. I think, Betsy, you listened to it as well, where Brad Ritchie, the state's emergency response office director, was asked if this, if rescinding the emergency declaration could affect vaccine distribution. And he said point blank, you should be concerned. The committee was not concerned enough to table the proposal. They sent it to the Senate floor where it's awaiting a vote, potentially could come up for a vote at any point. So yeah, the governor is taking the fight to the legislature. There's no two ways around it.
So what do you think happens next? I mean, because the governor, as we said, this is the strongest that we've seen him come out. I mean, he said he respects his colleagues in the legislature. He's been happy to work with them in the past, but he said not only is this shameful, they're not telling the truth. So Betsy, I mean, you and Kevin both, you have covered the legislature for years. This is, I mean, it kind of feels like we're starting to watch a boxing match here.
Well, I did speak with Senate President Pro Tem Chuck Winter prior to the governor's announcement. And of course, at that point, we didn't know what the governor was going to say. And Senator Winter told me that the Senate Republicans were actually going to be in a caucus during the governor's announcement, and that one of the things they're looking at, and one of the reasons that very resolution that Kevin mentioned is on hold, is that they might draft a different version, perhaps one more focused on restrictions having to do with the pandemic than the emergency declaration itself. Nevertheless, they received those warnings from General Ritchie in committee this week, and they passed the resolution anyway on a party line vote. I also spoke with Speaker Scott Behnke, and I'm not sure that the House is going to be as responsive perhaps as the Senate to the governor's message. Speaker Behnke told me that he thinks there's support in the House for things like a resolution that isn't currently on the House's calendar to attempt to eliminate all restrictions on gatherings statewide immediately related to the COVID-19 pandemic. Now, there are questions as to whether the legislature can even do that. That resolution, unlike the other one, does not target the emergency declaration. And the governor's message today was about the danger of targeting the emergency declaration and the cost to Idaho citizens. There was an earlier resolution introduced in the House to just do away with the emergency declaration entirely, admitting up front that we would forfeit all federal aid. And I think that's part of what the governor was referring to. That resolution is still in committee.
You know, and another tidbit maybe to give you a sense of where this goes from here and what happens next. In my inbox here from just a few minutes ago, there's a release from the Idaho Association of Commerce and Industry, IACI, perhaps one of the most powerful lobbying groups in the state house, siding with Governor Little, saying, you know, we should be very cautious and very concerned about doing anything that would undermine getting past the coronavirus pandemic, saying, you know, businesses have been suffering for a year. We're close to the end. We've got to continue to make right choices. You know, IACI, kind of like Governor Little, IACI doesn't make its bones by picking fights publicly with the legislature. I mean, they work with the legislature and they're pretty successful at getting most of what they want from the legislature most years. So it's significant to see IACI weigh in so quickly and side with the governor on this. I think this debate's going to escalate.
Something else to keep in mind at the local level is it's not just the state that benefits from these dollars. What local governments do is they use the emergency declaration as a way to access federal aid. And the city of Boise is relying on the ability to get reimbursed by FEMA later to pay for some of its response to the pandemic, like housing homeless people in hotel, homeless families, and people who are medically at risk, who are also homeless in hotels, to slow the spread of COVID-19 in homeless shelters. There's been at least one death so far that happened last year in the homeless shelter system here in Boise. And that's something that the city has been really concerned about. And so if this emergency declaration is suspended, there is a possibility that it means the city of Boise can't be reimbursed for those funds, and it would take a big hit out of the city's budget that has already had to do a few layoffs and some cost cutting as we're heading into the next budget year, which could mean an increase to property taxes or further cuts to services. This isn't just a state thing. This could hit where we are at home, you know, in your local communities. And I'm sure there are other local governments statewide that are planning to be reimbursed from FEMA for costs incurred during the pandemic as well.
Right. So there's a domino effect, Margaret, because you're right. It's not just the city of Boise. It's any municipality who is relying on these FEMA dollars when we get through this pandemic.
And Gemma, I think that what we have been hearing from the legislature thus far in their session, which in the 2 weeks so far that it's been going, has been a strong and overwhelming sentiment among the Republican majority that they wish to just declare the pandemic over and get back to normal.
Well, and wouldn't we all?
Yes. And the message from the governor today was that the actions that they are taking to further that desire might have the opposite effect if they stop the rollout of the vaccine, the very things that are designed to help us get out of this and get back to normal.
We have to take a quick break. We are going to be back with our reporter roundtable, digging in more to this, but also A lot more to get into for this week. So more Idaho Matters next. And we're back with our reporter roundtable, our panel today, Kevin Richert with Idaho Ed News, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spachek, Rachel, I'm sorry, it's so hard for me to get your last name right, reporter with Idaho Press, and Betsy Russell, Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press. Rachel, my apologies. I apologize. I want to go back to the State House for a moment. We were talking about the news briefing that the Governor Little gave in our last segment. And, you know, Betsy, I think you said something, frankly, you know, fairly obvious but profound, is that many in the Republican Party, in the legislature, just want to say the pandemic is over, it's done, let's move on, let's stop this emergency declaration. With that said, though, I mean, Kevin, there was already a COVID case at the State House. Because the majority of legislators are unmasked, and I'm sure that this won't be the only case that we see.
You know, I'm afraid to say that I think that's practically inevitable. I think when you have that many people in the building, not necessarily adhering to social distancing, not wearing masks, I don't see how you can get through this session without additional cases. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, I hope. It sounds like from Betsy's reporting that this attaché was asymptomatic. So you hope that the attaché recovers quickly. You hope there isn't an outbreak stemming from that case. I mean, I'm not hoping for an outbreak at the legislature, but I don't think anybody should be surprised that we've seen a case this early on in the session. And it's part of the reason why a number of us in the media and a number of folks who would normally be at the State House in a lobbying capacity or in a capacity as concerned, engaged citizens. I think that's why a number of people are staying away and watching this legislature via the online stream.
Mm-hmm. Betsy, you recently wrote about the co-equal branches of government. Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because, you know, in a lot of ways, what we just saw from the governor kind of plays into that, right? Of these different branches of government and how they are supposed to work together.
So this came up during the House's debate this week on a proposed constitutional amendment to let the legislature call itself back into session, in special session, anytime that 60% of the members of each house want to do that. Currently, under the Idaho Constitution, only the governor can call the legislature back into special session. And so this measure passed the House with more than a two-thirds majority. It now goes to the Senate. In order to change the Constitution, it would have to go to the voters at the November 2022 general election. But during the debate, a number of House members said they want to do this because they don't believe we have three co-equal branches of government in Idaho, and they don't think we should. Representative Barbara Ehart said quite clearly that she believes the legislature should be the main branch of government, should be greater than in power than the executive, and that the judiciary should have the least power of all. And there were quite a number of other representatives who weighed in and agreed with her that they don't think we should have co-equal branches of government. And so I did talk with a law professor about this, a constitutional law expert, because I'd always been taught we had co-equal branches of government.
Kind of part of our Constitution.
Right. Well, in our Idaho Constitution, it does not use the word co-equal, but it talks about how powers are separated between three distinct departments and none may exercise any of the duties of the other. And if you look at Idaho Supreme Court decisions over the years, the word co-equal branches of government appears frequently. Now, the same is true at the federal level. The U.S. Supreme Court has frequently referred to co-equal branches of government, but apparently some scholars over the years have debated this and suggested that maybe Congress is more representational and should be considered more powerful because they make the laws. Of course, others would argue, well, the courts can overturn the laws that Congress makes, so are they more powerful? But it's a system of checks and balances. And there was a famous case in 1974 involving President Nixon. And the U.S. Supreme Court in that case said President Nixon couldn't assert executive privilege and refused to comply with a subpoena with regard to the Watergate break-in because we have co-equal branches of government and none of them can act completely independently of the other. They are checks and balances on the other. So we're having some interesting discussions and even civics lessons around the statehouse this week.
Oh, well, and it's so fascinating, Betsy, because when we think of that, right, it is this system of checks and balances, and all kinds of things can happen, good or bad, when you take that out of the equation. And frankly, that is what our republic is supposed to be, is this checks and balances, right? So it's fascinating, some of the discussions, I think, that go on in the statehouse during the session. Go ahead, Betsy.
Well, I was just going to say it's not new. The legislature has been trying to assert more power over the executive branch for several years. And part of their argument is, well, we are elected by the people. Well, of course, each legislator was elected by a district that includes 30 to 40,000 people. The governor was elected by all the people in the state. They all vote on the governor.
Yeah, so there's that, right? Yeah, exactly.
Kevin. I should add. So I wrote about this week, too, and the highlight of my week was being able to link to a Schoolhouse Rock segment in the story that I wrote about this. So I feel like I should retire for the week just for doing that. But
I think
this is not unique to Idaho. 25 states have, in 25 states at least, legislatures are pushing legislation to look at emergency powers and look at the separation of powers issue. So this is hardly a unique issue to Idaho. And it kind of makes me wonder how this whole issue of the funding may play out. To what extent would Idaho become this test case in the question of whether a state can still receive FEMA funds after rescinding an emergency declaration? I mean, there are a lot of interesting possibilities as this issue plays out.
Yeah, 100%. So, Margaret, another thing that happened this week that frankly seems to have kind of gone by the wayside because of what we've been talking about today is what happened with an appointment to the Central District Health Department. Ada County Commissioners appointed a former lawmaker, Raul Labrador. So get us up to date on that, Margaret, because this was not without controversy.
Definitely not. So after former Ada County Commissioner Diana Lacciando, you know, left her office, she resigned her position on Central District Health. And at the first open business meeting for the newly elected Republican Ada County Commissioners, they named Congressman Raul Labrador as their
pick,
their former congressman, my bad, as their appointee to Central District Health. And it was kind of a surprise. The name wasn't on the agenda, and there were accusations that they broke the open meeting law by making the decision prior to that happening. The commissioners deny that, and it is currently under investigation by Canyon County Prosecutor Brian Taylor to see if there was any wrongdoing there. And after sort of an outcry, they decided to take more applicants, have another vote on Tuesday, and they considered another epidemiologist, and Dr. Sky Blue. And so they considered that, and they heard from him, and then they decided to just stick with former Representative Labrador. And there's a lot of criticism in the community of saying, why would they select someone who is a political actor who's really seemed to be only interested in Central District Health because of the COVID-19 issue, as opposed to the normal day-to-day business of septic tanks, restaurant inspections, sexually transmitted diseases, and other things that CDH normally deals with. And in their questioning, they did bring up the possibility of this candidate being able to serve and another term whenever Dr. Epperle, the other Ada County representative, leaves the board. But I think there were a lot of people surprised to see that they went with the more political choice instead of the, you know, more medical choice.
Mm-hmm. And with that said, I mean, you know, former Representative Labrador has made he has made statements in regards to thinking that you know, the use of masks are not as as effective as scientists say that they are. In fact, he even said that you know, we need common sense on Central District Health, not necessarily medical doctors. And Betsy, and then in the middle of all of this, when this is going on, Labrador registers to be a lobbyist for some health groups.
That's right. And the former congressman registered as a lobbyist for several interest groups last spring. But right during the same time period that he was seeking this health board appointment, he signed on three new paying clients, paying lobbyists, lobbying clients who are healthcare entities. And there was concern raised that perhaps there might be a conflict of interest in that. The former congressman says he sees no conflict and his lobbying activities are separate from his seeking the position on the Central Health District Board. But when Idaho Press reporter Blake Jones inquired with one of the clients yesterday about this decision, before they commented on it, they revoked it and terminated their lobbying contract with Raul Labrador. He's also controversial on health issues in general. Back when he was serving in Congress, he very famously said, "No one dies for lack of access to healthcare." And he said that at a town hall meeting. So he has staked out a very outspoken political approach to public health issues that's focused a lot of attention on him as a candidate for this particular board right now that's in the spotlight.
And then, Rachel, and we should note then here we have all of this going on, right? And you just recently wrote about how we still have a shortage of direct care workers.
Yes. So it's all, yeah, it's all pretty bad. and it's not just an Idaho issue. It's kind of a nationwide issue. But yeah, basically everyone's facing a huge, severe shortage of direct care workers. And these are workers either in long-term care facilities, which we know have been impacted by COVID. And they are also workers who, you know, go directly to people's homes. And these are people who are elderly or mentally or physically disabled. But essentially, you know, some of these people cannot get out of bed without one of these direct care workers. And I talked to Pam Wiley in Boise. She's paralyzed from the neck down, and she recently lost one of her workers to COVID. And she essentially told me that she spends hours in bed because there's no one to help her out in the morning. Mm-hmm. So she doesn't eat, she stays in bed. And this is something that the state is seeing for a ton of these clients. And basically the issue is that these workers can make as low as $10 and as much as $12. And they're leaving the industry to work at Target with Amazon coming into Nampa, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's quite severe, and people need these workers.
We'll take a quick break. More with our reporter roundtable right after this. Continuing with our reporter roundtable right now, Kevin, you wrote recently about something else that's getting could be controversial, and this is adding more spectators at high school sporting events. This is something that Governor Little is now advocating for.
Well, and this all kind of ties us back into where we started this
right.
hour. This was the thrust of one of the resolutions that came out of the House State Affairs Committee that would lift all of the governor's restrictions on public gatherings. But really the debate has been about number of spectators at high school sporting events. And the governor has scaled back those restrictions on a couple of occasions and scaled them back again on Wednesday in response, I would say pretty clearly, in response to the legislature's push to get rid of these crowd restrictions. I mean, in that sense, he did kind of blink a little bit in light of some pressure maybe coming from the legislature. He cited the decline in new coronavirus case numbers and hospitalizations, all accurate. The numbers do bear that out, and that is some encouraging news here. But yes, he instructed the State Board of Education to come back with new and somewhat relaxed restrictions on crowd attendance. Our Sammy Edge wrote about that today, and she has the full rundown of the new requirements. You can see it on our website. But I think this is the session. The session right now is a battle between the legislature and the governor over a variety of different coronavirus responses and authorities.
And it's right, absolutely. A push and pull there, because the House passed this very far-reaching resolution that we don't even know if it's legal, to do away with all restrictions on gathering statewide related to COVID-19. But they said, and the sponsor said, it was specifically in response to these high school sporting events, or actually all school sporting events restrictions. And it does seem like the governor's immediate announcement that he's going to relax those restrictions is being quite well received in the legislature. Will it be enough to stop that resolution? Who knows?
It was enough to at least put it on hold. It was due for a vote on Thursday. It's been put on hold at least until Monday. So, tune in Monday and see if the House takes it up.
Well, and just as a mom, not as a journalist, I think your kids are going to be okay if you don't see them play sports for a season or a year. The good news, though, Kevin, and you mentioned this briefly, is that we are actually seeing the numbers go down a bit in regards to COVID cases, to deaths, to hospitalizations. But I think it's very important to say we're not in the clear by any means.
We're not in the clear. But what I find interesting about the decline in new case numbers and hospitalizations and deaths is that, first of all, we're just in the beginning of the vaccine rollout. I mean, we're less than 1% of the population has both doses of vaccine. So I find it hard to believe that any kind of decline in case numbers has anything to do with the vaccine rollout in this early stage of the game. The other thing that's really interesting, though, about the case numbers declining is we are 4 weeks today removed from Christmas Day. We're 3 weeks removed from New Year's Day. A lot of health experts were really concerned that we were going to see a spike in cases coming out of the holidays that would put even more pressure on a stressed healthcare system. It doesn't look like that's bearing out at this point. Obviously we watch those numbers every day and we crunch the numbers and we're very thoughtful in looking at those numbers and the trends. But right now, the trends do appear to be heading in the right direction, for now at least.
At right. the same time, there are these new strains that are being identified that are more contagious. And there's a lot of concern among public health officials mm-hmm. that we don't know how that increased contagiousness will affect the spread of the virus across the country or in Idaho. And at this point, we just don't know.
Right. And at least with the vaccine, Kevin, the National Guard has been activated again to help with the rollout here in our state, but that would be affected if we go back to what we heard in regards to rescinding this emergency order. With that said, though, more teachers are getting vaccinated. And I know there are teachers at my kiddo's school who have gotten their first dose. And I mean, there is such a sense of relief to see our teachers finally getting this.
Right. So our clerk Corbin did a really terrific story about this week, and he spoke to some of the teachers who have been waiting for their vaccine and have really jumped at the opportunity. And we don't know exactly how many teachers have gotten the vaccine. The estimate that we've got, and it is a low-end estimate, is that at least 1,400 teachers and school staff, K-12 school staff, have been able to get the vaccine so far. But, you're right, Gemma. It's an extension of what we're seeing in our daily lives. It's an extension of what we see on our social media feeds. I mean, there isn't a day that goes by when I don't see something from a friend of mine, either in the education space or first responder space, saying, I just got my first vaccine. Here's me and my card, you know, taking a selfie after my first vaccination. I mean, it is, you know, that's the story that's unfolding in our all around us as people are starting to get the vaccines. And Governor Little surely played on that in his comments this afternoon, saying, you know, we're putting that in jeopardy here. So, you know, kind of an interesting juxtaposition, you know, the hopefulness that you're seeing from people who are getting the vaccine and kind of the ominous warning that we heard from the governor this afternoon.
Let's take one more quick break. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, at the same time, I think we are seeing a lot of people getting their vaccine and that excitement, but there are a lot of mounting questions about how many Idahoans are going to take the vaccine.
Right.
You know, this state has high levels of vaccine hesitancy, you know, some of the highest in the nation. We've had prominent big demonstrations from anti-vax groups at the state house and elsewhere in the community. I think there's a strong sentiment of anxiety around this vaccine. And, you know, we're going to have to see what those eventual numbers look like. I've heard anecdotally that in rural areas, they've gone through and vaccinated all the healthcare workers they are going to vaccinate, and, you know, ready to move on to stage two purely, or I don't think that's the right word, but the next group, purely because there are not enough people who want to participate. And there's been some unfounded misinformation in the country about the Biden administration making vaccines mandatory. We haven't seen, you know, the Biden administration has said, you know, a couple times that they don't want to do that, that they want to keep it voluntary. But we'll see under that voluntary, you know, while it's voluntary, we're going to have to, a voluntary vaccine means that not everyone is going to take it. And that could have some real implications on our long-term recovery from the pandemic health-wise. Mm-hmm.
Let's take a quick break. More with our roundtable next. Wrapping up our reporter roundtable right now. Rachel, you wrote an article recently in regards to rule changes with pesticides. And these changes are coming from the Department of Agriculture, yes?
Yes. So we've been hearing about these changes for, it kind of started last session and it's leaked into this session with the Idaho State Department of Agriculture, basically removing some rules and then adding a few others. And it's kind of a big deal because last spring or maybe spring 2 years ago, there was a huge pesticide exposure incident in Parma that my friend and fellow reporter Nicole Foy did a lot of coverage on. A bunch of farm workers got sick, and there wasn't a lot of the state could do to help them and to regulate that applicator. So basically what we're looking at is the Department of Ag is removing some prohibitions that are covered in federal rules, specifically the Federal Aviation Administration rules. And these are how low that you can fly as an aerial applicator over congested areas. So we're talking about cities, schools, hospitals. And so kind of concerning there, because in many discussions, there hasn't been anyone from the FAA to clarify these rules. And so a lot of farm worker advocates are concerned that these removals will, you know, just create kind of weirdness around who regulates, who looks out for the farm workers. So kind of concerning in that area.
Betsy, I want to talk about the arts community for a moment, because we know that so many industries have been hit so incredibly hard when it comes to the pandemic. But we've seen a great number of job loss when we talk about the arts community.
That's right. I had a story in the Idaho Press today that we have learned that Idaho has lost 30% of its jobs in the arts just since the pandemic started. That is more than 11,000 people who have lost their livelihoods. And the Idaho State Commission on the Arts estimates $277 million in lost earnings because of that. Their response has been to hand out some small grants using CARES Act funds to try to help some artists and some arts organizations. They're saying it's helped measurably, but it's not going to save anybody. I mean, you get a grant for $1,000 and you've lost a year's worth of income. It's going to help, but it's not going to save you. So things, from what we heard, it's been a very tough year for the arts in Idaho.
And Kevin, you sit on the board of the Boise Phil, and I'm sure, and you're a musician in your own right, you've had to have seen this firsthand with, I mean, and because they're all trying to find ways to still create art, because frankly, especially in a time like this, we need it. But this is a tremendous loss.
On a personal scale, it's a big void in my life. I miss singing. I miss being in the chorale. Our season's been completely on hold. The Phil board met last night, and we were talking about the options of what 21-22 season might look like. And it's hopeful to be at least be able to talk about what the options might be in terms of live performance as opposed to virtual performances that the Phil's been doing. And trying to get singers back together, trying to get musicians back on the same stage together, trying to get audiences back together. But to Betsy's point and to her story, it has been such a rough year, and there's still so much uncertainty about where this is going to end up.
Yeah. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy day, especially during the legislative session, guys. Really, really appreciate you coming on the program, talking about all of this with us, but also the work that all of you do to keep all of us informed. So appreciate it. We've been talking with Kevin Richert with Idaho Education News, Margaret Carmel, reporter with BoiseDev.com, Rachel Spacek, reporter with the Idaho Press, and Betsy Russell, Boise Bureau Chief at the Idaho Press. Happiest of Fridays, everyone.
Thanks, Gemma.
Thanks, Gemma. Thanks for having us.
Absolutely. Have a good weekend. And I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters as well as we continue to navigate 2021. Really do appreciate all of you participating and being a part of Idaho Matters. Remember, you can always send us an email at idahomatters@boisestate.edu, because if you have a question, you have a comment, maybe you have an idea for the show, maybe there's something going on that we need to cover that we don't know about, well, you know what? Let us know. We would love to hear from you so that we are covering the topics that matter to you. So again, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Big thanks to our producers, Frankie Barnhill and Samantha Wright. Our theme music was written and produced by Boise musician Will Hall. And our general manager is Tom Michael, and our programming director is Paul Stribling. I'm Gemma Gaudette. It is Friday. I hope you have a nice weekend. I hope you find some joy in your day. And of course, we'll see you back here on Monday.